This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Rum, do you hear something?
Yeah, what is that?
It's a bird. No, it's a plane. No, it's not that.
Ooh, it's the best of the Buzz with Bill.
Is that right, eh? It's a good sign of things to come.
Commentary on trending headlines with veteran AMI producer Bill Shackleton.
Well, now.
Billy!
I say, Shaq!
Yep, I'm back. Apple will let its users repair their own devices. This is long and long overdue. Basically, this is comes from a backlash of consumers who feel cheated when it comes to getting their own, getting their not only devices but farming machinery repaired. Mm-hmm. You know, these manufacturers, what they do is they make it difficult to get parts, and then plus they make you go to their dealers, their representatives, and of course they get a cutback. So it's to their advantage if you make people go to their source to get anything repaired. So Apple is now going to be allowing, I guess starting next year, allowing people to repair, I believe it's iPhone 12 and up, and only certain like camera displays, like and batteries, you will be able to basically replace. And they are going to be publishing manuals online to show you how to do this. And I think I did an article several months ago about a woman who was qualified to fix her own phone who wanted to and couldn't get parts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is. This is great for if I need a new battery in a phone, I don't have to go into a Rogers store. Apparently, I can just buy, I'll be able to buy the parts. And apparently, Apple is charging the same price as they would charge their dealers to fix.
Which, remember, Rumya, they had that, if you tampered, if you know, when people were back in the jailbreak days and everything like that. But if you tampered with them, default on
it's
your warranty.
Useless now. Exactly. Exactly. You know what, though? We know that when Apple does something, it does it well. Okay, fine. I'm a huge Apple user, but I'm just saying, right? Like they do it well with accessibility. They do it well with, you know, the hardware, the stuff that they've come out with lately, everything. They're very, very innovative, and that's wonderful. But yeah, Apple products, it's like you can't open up anything Apple. You're not able to do stuff like that anymore. And it's not just Apple. Well, it's everything like you're saying, Billy. You're not able to like – do it on your own anymore. And that's why the right to repair movement is just people are super upset that they can't. You have to toss away things and go and rebuy everything yourself or upgrade to new devices. But if they take this opportunity, like you're talking about, right, and make it available, not just the parts, but the manuals, you know, really embrace this whole thing and say, here's all the parts, we're selling it to you at the same price, you don't need to go outside of Apple to try to figure this out on your own, and here are the manuals to do it yourself. I'm pretty sure that they'll do it well.
Will
and
it
it's not going to hinder anything. I hope so. I mean, even if it's not accessible for me per se, imagine what it'll be like to walk into a store and say, okay, yeah, I know this is not warranty covered, but I want to buy the part anyway, and can you guys fix it, right? It's still right to repair. It's still not the same as my iPhone 12 is cracked up and now I need to upgrade. It's the only way for me to deal with it.
So it's just, that was the one thing that when we started to have rechargeable stuff, I remember, Billy, the first thing I thought of is, yeah, but then I can't fix problems. I can't deal with stuff. And, you know, if this thing goes bad and they tell me, well, this is corrupt, this is whatever, it's done. And that was one of the things that people, when you started to really see the throwaway society that we had become. And
exactly.
I am anxious to see how this goes, where Apple's comfortable that, yeah, you had it open, because so many people are going to be afraid and say, yeah, hold on a sec. Does that default my warranty? Or is this something I'm only able to do? Will you give me a warranty that'll last so long? And the only way and time I would ever open up to change the battery on my own, save myself some money, is out of warranty,
yes.
Which makes sense, right? Obviously, why are you messing around with it if it's under warranty? They would expect you still, well, just bring it in. It's under warranty. What are you kicking about?
I wonder what they're going to do, though. I mean, if you take something back and say you didn't break it and you really did, I wonder how they're going to handle that. Because
it's amazing what they can tell, though.
I guess.
Yes. And it's the same as you going and buying the parts and bringing it home and fixing it yourself. Who cares if it's you or someone else who broke it? right? That's what I'm hoping it'll be like, regardless of who broke your screen or why your ventilation needs fixing and why it's full of dust and whatever. Like all these simple things that could honestly make your devices last way longer that we right now don't have access to except through third-party options.
So would you feel, though, if that was so possible to clean it out, make the device last longer, is that what Apple in the long run wants? Because the other way to beat that, I guess, is keep updating stuff enough and saying, well, yeah, but 12s or 13, 15, you know, whatever mm-hmm. your version is, won't work with this update, so that every 2 years you either have the option of keep fixing up your phone, convert it to an iPod-type device, or get a yeah. new one. So well, they're going to find that like angle. Right now. Well, they're going to find the angle.
Sometimes, though, I wonder when you look at it, why would they make you repair when they could make you buy a new one? So it's, as you say, it's going to be interesting. How much money are they actually going to lose by people not updating their devices?
Or having them fix yeah. silly things like batteries? Is it becoming too much of a nuisance?
Yeah, you know? That's right.
If exactly. we know we can go get a battery and deal with it that way, maybe that's their view is, yeah, but in the long run, we're saving money because now we don't have Bill plugging up the place coming in. I need another battery here, you know, and
see how everything locks it into the bigger picture, like, you know, environment change and climate awareness and all this stuff. I mean, I'm just throwing things out
no,
there.
No, but that's a good point because then they can yeah. say we're reusable, just what you were saying.
Exactly.
And they need to exactly. be. We need to be. The landfills, it's ridiculous what's going on.
Subway sandwich chain co-founder Peter Buck dies at 90. We all know Subway's, mm-hmm. but this is coming from Associated Press. But what we don't know maybe is how this whole thing got started. At the age of 17, a friend of his named Fred DeLuca asked Peter how he could make some extra money. And Peter said, open a sandwich shop. So in 1968, I believe they opened Fred's Super Sub Shop, and it was 65 cents or something like that for a sub. They didn't make a profit for 15 years.
Wow.
And then they changed the Subways. And actually, they have more outlets than McDonald's, apparently, and more than Tim Hortons. And both of those guys are billionaires. And can you imagine, Fred Buck was a physicist. Yeah. He worked wow. for the U.S. Well, he worked for the U.S. Navy.
Holy.
I remember Bill, I just remember as a kid being so confused by the name of the sandwich, a submarine sandwich, because we had in Montreal, we had Mike's Submarine and just so many of these great places to get sub sandwiches. And it would really confuse me that they were called that. And that, so it's really incredible when you think of that vision young teenagers had.
And I don't know, what's the difference between a Mr. Sub and a Subway Sub? I mean, what is the difference? Maybe, is it the bread? They all seem to have the same sort of types of sandwiches.
Yeah. Is it? Marketing, choice, and ownership. Mm-hmm. I think that's really, really, I think, I don't want to say there was more of a difference because now you have more types of bread and things like that that they can do, that they can offer. Back in the day, it was just sub sandwiches.
I guess.
Sub sandwiches guess you could just make at home, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what my mom would say when we went to Subway.
you can make them at home. We're not going to stop off. Mm-mm.
But it was the fun of it, wasn't it, Bill? It was just its own ritual.
And it's amazing just open up a shop. I mean, they never dreamt it would get, and of course, they're both billionaires.
Yeah, no kidding.
And no one ever.
15 years in debt. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, not in debt, yeah. just breaking even. Excuse me.
Just
now they have 40,000 plus locations.
40,000, yeah, that's right.
Around the world.
Around the world.
Bigger than McDonald's and Starbucks.
Our manager, Andy Frank, met Fred. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. 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 He had a Subway franchise at one point, and really cool that he had a chance to meet him. And really, really awesome. That's like cool, Andy.
Boy, if you could get a franchise, holy smokes! You know?
Like could you? Well, and that's the thing. I think like Andy in the time then, it would have been such a different era. But oh my goodness, you would think that because there's so many, they would dilute themselves. But look at Tim Hortons and look, as you said, there's more Subway than there is Tim Hortons. So incredible.
I'm going to do this first one because I'm familiar with it anyway. It's Jesus Christ Superstar is going to be making a comeback at the Prince of Wales Theatre.
That's right.
Yes. Now, from Associated Press, and why this is an interesting article for me and hopefully for our listeners. I mean, you'd have to be sort of my age to really understand how this came about. Written 50 years ago by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, you can well imagine the controversy of putting something in a biblical context to rock and roll. I mean, it was like unheard of. It was very risque, and they never realized, first of all, they didn't know if anybody would ever stage it, but little did they know that it really took off in North America. It didn't do so well in Britain, but it did take off in North America. And as controversial as it was, became very successful. I had the album, and I actually got to see it live. And I'm interested to know if I ever get a chance, the new version, what it's going to sound like.
Well, I think it's kind of cool to as you pointed out, some of that initial reaction to Jesus Christ Superstar, right? Like having the music and whether it would be successful or not. But I'm not surprised at all that it would take off in, I was going to say New York City, but, you know, North America. Because just stuff like this feels like old stuff made new. Right. And I know, was it last year or 2 years ago when John Legend was, they were doing an airing of it. Yeah. And he was going to play.
NBC. Yeah.
Exactly. And it was so widely spread and so like it was very well attended as well. Right. Like the airing and stuff. So it's cool. But this is significant because it's coming to Canada. Right, Billy?
It is. And you wonder what I'm interested in is how it's going to be received by the younger people today, because as I say, it's 50 years ago when it was. And I don't know how it's going to be, who's going to be able to relate to this other than me and people my age or whatever.
Well, but I wonder if they would tweak it because of that.
I don't even know if they would, because it is the story that it is. And I don't think you would need to if you're going to roll this out. But again, Rum, going back to what you said, the interest for people who wanted to see it, who remembered the older people or whatever you want to say, and I don't even know if it matters, is the artists, what you're going to do, what you're going to see, how are you going to make it a live, which was part of the event. It was done live for people. So I think when you get things like that rolled out there, and so many people, a lot of reason we don't look at the stuff 50 years ago is the younger people, or when I say younger people, okay, people, you know, 40 and below look at it and say, ugh. They don't like the footage. It's you know, no matter how great it is, it's still dated.
Yeah, that's true. Go ahead, Billy.
No, the story, just for people who don't know, it tells a story of the last 7 days of Jesus Christ's life as told through his disciple Judas Iscariot, who basically betrayed him. So a lot of good music come out of there, a lot of, you know, and it will be interesting to see. I wasn't able to find out who's performing in it, but I'm hoping it works.
So for you back, you know, you were very young. When's your first recollection of it? And was it something your parents got watching or wanted to see as a play or what?
No, one of the guys at Brant at the W. Ross McDonald School had the album. And it had some scary music at the beginning of it. And of course, I love scary music. And I got to get that album because it's scary music. And I got the album. And then I got my parents to drag me to the O'Keefe, the Royal Alec, to see it live. And that's how that came about. But it came about because of the scary music at the beginning.
Right. Right.
Which was, you know,
not even the story or anything.
No,
not so much the story, the music. No.
I remember my parents talking a lot about it. I remember when it came on television, when they did the movie. I remember it being an experience to watch because of how popular everything was, from the play to the show and so on, and the story itself, and how much of the music, you know, went on the music charts. So very, very interesting, Bill. And when you see these things 50 years later, and I do think, I don't want to, you know, some people say Rum, oh, it's timeless, it's a classic, it's a blah, 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 blah. I don't necessarily feel that way.
I don't think that's the
case at all. No, I feel it's something people, they're curious of. And I just kind of say we overuse that, folks. It's something they're redoing for a different kind of audience, yet the same audience.
If we were talking about Harry Potter, then we could call it a classic. Well, no. So
you don't even have to do that, because people like you just watch it 1,000 times. Why would they ever spend money to redo any of it?
Exactly. Shush, the cursed child's coming out. Okay, so the thing is with the music and the type of thing. Like, if you're into musicals, if you're into Broadway performance, you're probably going to check it out because of all the traction it's gotten, right? But you're not going to do it just because the story interests you, unless, like, Bill, you've been pointing out, you're in that age range and it's significant to you.
Right.
But for me, I would want to know that the music is good.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I don't really, I'm not so sure, you know, the story itself, you understand what it is, and that kind of thing. I think it really, the pull was the performance, the music, the dancing.
How about this one? Independent websites team up to boost local journalism. This is an American story from the Associated Press. So there is a group of websites that are promoting, well, if they get going, and it's called the Rural News Network. It's going to be promoting indigenous cultures, going to be promoting severe weather. And these people feel that we are lambasted by mainstream media. And basically what they want to do is they feel that local newspapers, or at least local websites that are in their own local communities, have their ears and eyes on the ground, as it were. And they want to promote more local coverage. I mean, after all, you're on the site. You're not reporting from 100 to 200 miles away, you're actually there on the scene. And I think this is, again, it's because of the main news media that we're being bombarded with. There's not enough local journalism, according to these people, and they're going to change that. And it's really high time that they do, and maybe we can do that here. I don't know.
Well, Bill and Rum, you know, this is one of those things that you'll hear the old timers like us talk about back in the days when you had a local newscast. Now, Toronto people, you guys get local news. But when you're talking places like our London down to Windsor and throughout the rest of the country, newsrooms fold up at 6 o'clock at night, and they only fire up at 6 o'clock in the morning for a few hours. And sometimes you don't even have someone midday that's really reporting a lot. They're there in case there's something that happens and preparing other things. Billy, this was the way to know what was going on locally, not just traffic, not just, you know, if a storm comes up. There was so much that people went out and covered, and budgets have said, nope, not going to be able to do that, except on college or university stations. That's where you'll see that reflected, because you got students trying to, you know, do a broadcast career, or volunteers at a community station. This is one of those things. Rum, do you feel like you actually know, even in Toronto, what's going on reasonably well locally?
You know what? And that's an interesting question, because Toronto is still a huge urban city, right? Like, it's just huge. So all the stuff that happens locally, which, yes, the answer is yes, I feel like we know about it. We can find it. It may not be in your daily digest, but it's there. The information is there if you want to find it. But when I think rural, I think that it would get lost. Like the reason why initiatives like this are important is because it would get lost because of all the bigger stories and the more pressing news articles that happen around your country in the bigger places like Toronto just eat up everything, right? So you wouldn't hear about some of the things that are going on, stories, events, like local initiatives and things like that, because everything else is just so big and just so available all the time.
Mm. And we get so much now, Billy, first person reports from you who happens to be sitting there wondering, why is there a traffic buildup or whatever? And you're out tweeting. Anyone know why there's a backup on so-and-so, right, which starts the conversation going? But it sounds like here these folks want to have those more reporter people investigating on the ground.
Well, it's like you're there. And yeah, I don't know where they're going to get the revenue for. The problem, of course, is doing these things. Where are you going to get your revenue from?
Yeah. But yeah, it's not like the old time where it was there through commercial dollars.
Yeah, that's right. And when you take a city like Toronto, it's too big. I mean, when you talk local news, you're talking, we need to know what's happening in Scarborough or Pickering or Oshawa or some of these other places. And if when you talk Toronto, it's like, is local news? No, it really isn't, because Toronto's too big.
Yeah. I mean, I remember
when you talk. Sorry, go ahead, Chaos.
I was just going to say, I remember doing theater stuff in the 80s in Toronto and being in the Mirror. And it was a big rush to be, oh, wow, you know, I'm in the North York Mirror versus, the, you know, what goes on now if it gets reported on. Go ahead, Rem.
And that's really interesting, because I was going to say similarly, you know, when you say Scarborough, Billy, I used to think, yeah, but Scarborough's Toronto, who cares, right? But now it's totally true. Scarborough has its own community, just like parts outside of Toronto, but right in that suburban area, they have their own communities, right? And the own like local news that you won't get a piece of if you're just searching Toronto.
Yep. Well, and as much as London's London, I you know, if you say to somebody in East London, how, when was the last time you were in West London, out in Byron? I've never been out there, you know, or over in Lambeth. Mm-hmm. It's not like where you're all over. You say to someone in West Toronto, hey, when's the last time you hung out in Scarborough? I've barely hung out, and I've spent many a time and years in Toronto, just as much as a lot of other citizens. And there are certain areas of Toronto I never have to go down there to the beaches or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing is that we are more diversified, and that's why this is so important. And even in this country, we're more diversified. And well, I think that's what these people are trying to cover.
And covering Indigenous stories, covering rural stories, covering weather. You know, we know we're talking so much right now about the environment. And I think that is what emphasis they're trying to spread, that, folks, we've got this big, beautiful country. Don't you want to hear more about it? The issues, and be connected. It's so hard to stay connected in a big country, let alone if we're not even connecting in our own communities, neighborhoods, or regions.
Uber's back in the news, folks. Apparently, U.S. is suing Uber, saying wait times discriminate against people with disabilities. Did you hear Muthan's that one?
Muthan's laughing at this, and they're sort of like Facebook, aren't they, sometimes?
I know. That's what I was thinking. I'm like, when did they ever leave the news? But yeah, okay, go ahead. So wait times or wait fees?
Yeah.
Wait times. Happening? Well, it's a bit of both.
Yeah, apparently what's happening is the U.S. is the OJ, the Department of Justice, is suing Uber because when an Uber car arrives, they wait 2 minutes and then the meter starts. So basically what happens is if you have a disability, does it take you longer to get in the car? If you have a wheelchair and it has to be folded up, or whatever, or what happens if you're vision impaired and the car is right in front of you and they don't identify themselves as an Uber driver? How do you know they're there?
Oh, so what if you're a businessman that just says, wait, I'm paying enough. You sit here while I finish this call and have my cigarette.
That's right.
That guy's not paying the extra except whatever the, you know, okay, sir, well, especially if you figure getting a big tip.
That's right. And but apparently these wait fees or wait time fees, apparently people have complained about it. Uber, in its response, has basically said that we have been in discussion with the Department of Justice, and they're disappointed in the lawsuit because apparently this has been under discussion now, or in the U.S. time. Anyway. So So which I guess is what they would naturally say.
Well, I think what catches me, what I've observed with this, was the fact that you got to be registered. So they're willing to make an exception for you and not charge you that late fee.
That's right.
But you have to be registered, which I'm not sure what, aren't you registered if you're using it? But I guess somewhere you've got to have proof or and again, I don't know if that's what's going to happen. There's going to be the follow-up of, okay, Ramya, if you're registering, could we please see a copy of your CNIB card to say that you're actually blind?
And the thing is, the two parts of it is, A, like you mentioned, for blind, low vision people, Billy, that you might be standing right in front of an Uber, but it's a busy area. You have no idea which is your vehicle, right? And you're trying to find each other. That has happened to me many times, and I've gotten charged.
Oh.
And I'm like, I can't see you, and we don't have like a proper signal or whatever to figure out where we are. And then the second one is, yes, like people with mobility devices or other devices that it takes a little longer to actually get into and settle into the car. But then I think the flip question is, how do we know people aren't going to use disability when, like, this can't be used if you're not actually on the scene?
That's
like, let's say you're just
registered.
5 minutes late coming down. Exactly.
Right. Oh, I see what you mean. You mean the driver saying they were there when they weren't, but also the flip coin of the registering thing is so that people don't pose as. But I'm still stuck back at you just said you've posed as a disabled person. Say, yes, well, I'm taking, you know, if I'm running late because I'm disabled, and they walk up limping or something, and a driver is not going to sit there and say, you're not disabled.
And they're 10 minutes getting to the Uber, but they weren't actually
playing
on the
game
scene.
And then claiming your disability. Right. Well, I'm vision impaired. I don't see well, whatever. And figuring that fee will be waived. But you just to go back to what you said, you've actually had to pay for this. Like you've been late because you couldn't find.
Absolutely.
Oh my
goodness. Okay. So like a busy, busy parking lots of a Walmart or a Costco, like these huge parking lots where Uber drivers are there, or even like, you know, valet areas where Ubers are there, but they're not looking for you and you're trying to find them and nobody can find each other. And then you get paid or charged the late fee. Even if they cancel and leave, you still get charged the late fee.
I know that. How much do they charge you for a late fee? Like I don't remember.
It's like $5 or $6, like close to $6, I think.
Is that right?
Minimum, yeah. And especially if they've waited and then they don't want to cancel, because you know, there's also this like unspoken thing of, well, you cancel first if you can't find me, right? But I'm not going to cancel because then I get stuck with the fee.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry. Well, I'm floored by that.
There's a lot of games to Uber. Yeah.
There certainly is. They play games. I had an experience yesterday. I didn't get my food, and I had to take away from the article, but I didn't get it. It never arrived. So and they did refund me. Yeah. So these dumb things do happen.
Well, they must have to sit down at the table with Facebook and teach each other. So what are you going to do this week? No, we're in the news this week. You guys go in next week. Go and screw around next week on everybody. I just am shocked when I read this and to think of the implications of it and that, you know, a government has to say, no, you don't get to do that. I mean, look, I understand wasting people's times and drivers that are out there and the games people play. I understand that. I know we work very hard that a person with a guide dog shouldn't have to call and say, I've got a guide dog, you know, but again, sometimes it's in their best interest so they don't have to deal with somebody leaving them at the corner, even though they shouldn't have
three times in a row.
Exactly. And neither should you have to pay because you couldn't find the car and he doesn't know to look for you because he's busy playing with his phone until you knock on his window and say, you're here for Kelly? Yeah, I know.
I'm going to squeeze this one. A German man drives to his own driving test. Now, on the face of it, it isn't funny, but you got a guy in Germany who can't drive a car.
What?
So he drives. Oh my gosh. He can't drive. So that's why he's taking driver's license. So he drives illegally to his own driver's test, and he screws up and gets himself arrested because, of course, he's careless driving. So he was asked why he was driving the car when he really shouldn't have been, because he didn't know how to drive. And he said, I didn't want to be late. So, you know, what can I say?
He didn't want to be late? That's why he...
Yeah, he didn't want to be late, oh my so he gosh. Drove the car, even though he shouldn't have driven. He didn't want to be late for his own test.
Okay, that's ridiculous. Right?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, why not?
Why not? It's like some of the stories that we hear of people telling us about how they drove to the CNIB to get their eyes checked, and then they got their license revoked because they shouldn't have been driving because their vision is that bad. You know, This is the first thing that came to mind for me. I'm like, why are you driving to your driver's test? You don't have a license. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I guess The guy didn't want to be late. Who knows? Yeah. I mean,
whatever, man. Yeah. Call yourself an Uber. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So, Billy, thank you so much. Very controversial and a lot of debating topics today.
Well, it came from the last one came was a prep kicker. So you know what those are. I mean, they're very kind of silly things and whatever.
Absolutely. But they still make us think. Thanks, Billy. We'll talk to you next week.
Later.
Bill Shackleton is a usual suspect on our show, Kelly and Company. You can catch Billy sneaking around the studio on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. And be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts for more of the buzz.
All right. See ya.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.